Hi, I'm Allison Hare, a former corporate executive on a quest to help you and me create a little more space and freedom in our all too busy lives. Welcome to the Late Learner Podcast, where we are breaking down old, tired paradigms. You know, like the ones we all live in. And here we discover more modern approaches that just plain work better for you. So what are we late learning today? Well, we truly are late learning as we are talking about being diagnosed later in life, specifically with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, and ASD, autism spectrum disorder. And we're talking all about high masking, high functioning, low functioning, and kind of reframing it all. And while there has been an uptick in adult diagnoses and suspicion that many people are underdiagnosed, women especially are finding out later in life, and often as a result of getting their children tested and a whole other multitude of factors. Personally, I got diagnosed last year at age of 48 with ADHD for the exact reason I mentioned. My daughter has ADHD, and I noticed that I have a lot of the same symptoms, but I have always overcompensated of those symptoms to manage it. And my guest today is late learner fan favorite, Cindy Robinson. Cindy is a sought-after parent and teen coach, specializing in working with people who are neurodiverse, and truly one of the most interesting people and thoughtful people I've ever met. She's so interesting that whenever she comes on this show, you, the listener, are so blown away by what you learn. And I just love hearing about your reactions. And once you put it into practice, how much it works, how much it helps. So I've been really super excited to release this one. And while she was diagnosed early on with ADHD, she was recently diagnosed on the autism spectrum at the age of 41. And what you may not realize is that what happens after you get diagnosed, there is a broad swath of processing on the other side and making accommodations that can be both liberating and scary. So Cindy has shared some really helpful frameworks in helping us make it easier to accommodate and for our loved ones as well. And speaking of our loved ones, let's get to the good stuff. What is stuff? It's the surprisingly true, useful fun fact. And this one is wild. There is a new study out of Rutgers University in New Jersey that stated that 1 in 4 teenagers, 25%, may have an undiagnosed case of being on the autism spectrum. Wow. If that is true, if there is a possibility that a quarter of us are running around feeling unsupported, I am not a doctor, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a statistician. But if so many of us are struggling with mental health issues, whether it's anxiety, depression, or struggling with loneliness, I wonder what kind of accommodations could be made if we knew why. I linked the study in the show notes if you want to go take a look for yourself. Now we are going to take a deep dive into the experience of the undiagnosed and what happens next. Here is my chat about high masking, low masking, and late diagnosis of ADHD and ASD with Cindy Robinson. We are back with the great Cindy Robinson. I know you hate when I call you the great Cindy Robinson, but welcome back to Late Learner Podcast.
Thank you very much.
So how would you define who you are? Introduce yourself if you may, because it evolves.
I guess so. I'm Cindy Robinson, and I am a coach for parents and teens primarily, but people who are neurodivergent, diagnosed with ADHD, autism, and OCD are kind of my areas of specialty. And I just coach them through the unmasking process.
So speaking of unmasking, we are talking today about high masking, and we're talking about high functioning of ASD, ADHD primarily, because both you and I were diagnosed very late. for ASD. And I think what's so funny about you, Cindy, is that you wrote a memoir, and in the memoir, you said the one test I've passed with flying colors was ADHD, but ASD was now.
Yep, that one was sneaky and behind the scenes.
It really was. So thinking about high masking and a high functioning, what is on your mind right now? Like, what is a concept that you've been turning around that you've been thinking about?
Yeah, I think it's this sort of, and I did know this before being diagnosed, but now living it myself, it's even more meaningful to me, is when people are talking in terms of autism, especially, but you see it with ADHD and other diagnoses as well, is they will categorize someone as being high functioning or low functioning. And primarily that means how well that person is functioning from the outside eye. And so a lot of people within the autism community would prefer terms like high masking or low masking, which means a better ability to hide their symptoms versus a lower ability to hide their symptoms. Because if you talk about functioning, if you say someone is low functioning, that person may not be able to mask their autistic symptoms very well, but if you ask them, well, how, you know, where are they with anxiety and depression and sort of those side effects to masking, they often don't have a lot of those symptoms. So they may be low functioning in terms of how we experience them. We can tell that they have autism, but internally they might be performing very well and doing okay and functioning pretty well internally. Versus a high masking person who we would label as high functioning, we don't feel that high functioning. Like, I'm functioning well for everyone else, but internally, it's not functioning so well.
Whoa. So this is like totally mind-blowing, because what you're saying is that if they're using the terms high functioning, it's high functioning for other people, but because it is for other people, there is a storm of anxiety or stress that is probably present underneath. Is that what you're saying?
That there might be. So just when you term somebody's diagnosis to be high or low functioning, you're basically just commenting on how well you can tell that they have that disorder. And that person may, or you don't, it doesn't tell you anything about how that person is doing internally. Whereas high masking and low masking is usually going to be much more centric to describe the person with the disorder versus our experience of them.
Yeah. So my expertise on the spectrum is love on the spectrum. That's about it. But there were several of them through the couple of seasons that were out that people would say, they would say, you don't look like you're autistic. That seems kind of offensive, right? But what is the proper response?
Yeah, I mean, the proper response depends on that person. And that's the thing, is turning it more person-centered. So each person with autism should be able to advocate for themselves in the way they want to. So for one person, they may be okay with explaining to someone that not everyone with autism looks the same. In fact, there's a big saying in the community of, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, because it's incredibly diverse. It's a neurotype. It's not really like a very specific disorder that looks a specific way. So you might feel like you want to educate people on that.
What does that mean? Neurotype? Because obviously it is a spectrum, but what is a neurotype?
I mean, essentially, if you really push anybody who works with autism, they ultimately can't tell you what it is. It's a collection of symptoms and often a collection of struggles in specific areas. And that's going to be like social areas. It's going to be in self-regulation areas. It's going to be a rigidity. Usually see restrictive or repetitive behaviors. So if you see enough of those behaviors in a person, or that person can articulate enough of those feelings as being their experience, then you can diagnose them with autism. But what is it? What causes it? What is there an autism gene? These types of things doesn't exist. It ultimately is a neurotype, which means it's just a way of the brain to operate. It's a huge net of people who are in that category.
So I'm curious about your own experience. So you've always had a heart for people with neurodivergence. So knowing that you were ADHD, you are a person who goes deep in a research hole. Like, you're the person that's like reading medical books for fun. Yeah. But I wonder, what was it like for you? And did you have suspicions that you might be on the spectrum? What did that look like?
Yeah, it was a bit of a mind effer.
Is it okay to say you're in your 40s?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I'm in 41. Your
41. And that's when I got diagnosed with autism, what I would call high masking or level one autism, but also people would refer to as high functioning. But yeah, it was a bit of a mind F because I knew that, like, you know, I work with teens and I would end up with all these autistic teens, and they would all be teens that the professionals are like, I don't know what to do with them. You know, what do I do with this kid? And I would feel that they were very effortless to work with.
Wow.
And so it should have been a bit of a clue of, like, I just thought I was really good at communicating with autistic people, but I never stopped to think, why am I so good at communicating with autistic people? So those should have been clues, but they definitely went over my head. I was able to make a huge effort to mask the symptoms. And so eventually I was talking with a professional who does psychological testing and saying, hey, like, I've done all this work. I know what's my ADHD. I've done all this trauma work and all the things that I was explaining as a trauma response. As my trauma is really lifting and healing and I feel that difference, there's still these weird symptoms that don't make sense. And so she said, oh, this could be like a high giftedness, a high intelligence symptom, or this could be autism. And so then I was like, oh, let me do the psych testing to figure it out.
Let me do the high intelligence one.
Girl, we'll let me tell you, I was so confident. I was like, oh, I'm a genius. I'm gifted. Like, I was so certain that I was a genius. Like, that was it. As soon as she said giftedness can look like this, I was like, oh my God, I'm a genius. And so during the testing, when she was doing all the IQ testy stuff and you're putting these puzzles together, I was like, I bet I'm blowing her mind right now.
Chart is going off.
Yes, I'm like putting this together so fast. She's probably so blown away at how smart I am. And then I got the psych ed test back and I was in literally the 50 percentile for intelligence. So like the most average basic intelligence that a person could have. And so I was like, oh shit, like, I'm not a genius. I'm freaking autistic. And so that was just I really had leaned into the giftedness and then quickly learned, no, I'm real average, no smarty over here, I'm autistic. And I think that is really important for me to share with people, because I thought I needed to have a trade-off. I thought, okay, I can be like this, I can have these symptoms, I can have these limitations, but if it's because I'm smart, then like, it's okay. But then learning, like, you're not smart and you have these deficits and you have these needs, I had to do a lot of work on being okay with it just being disabling, and that I didn't have some perk that I could provide the world with to make it okay that I was like this.
This feels really hard to hear, that you all of a sudden now have deficits that are identified. What did that look like?
Well, it's always been there, but I've just hidden it. So a lot of social deficits, a lot of backing out of social plans because I get so overwhelmed and afraid of those social interactions, which we would just call introvertedness. I would just kind of say
social anxiety.
I'm these things, but in reality, it's like a huge block. And I get very overstimulated and very overwhelmed in social situations. So I would hide that. I would hide the dysregulation, you know, the exhaustion that my body feels after doing something, and the rigidity to change. I would just force myself to eat foods and go places and do things that I would just be really uncomfortable with the entire time. But I would be like, if I did it, then I'm normal. So just tons and tons of masking of problems and struggles that I have, but I would just internalize the pain or discomfort or dysregulation, or I would be snappy with people I was very close with, would take it out on them, but the world would not see, you know, how dysregulated I would get.
But I wonder how much of this feels like normal life too, that people do get dysregulated, people do struggle with anxiety, people do struggle with it. So it makes a lot of sense that by nature you would feel like you're internalizing, why can't I just be outgoing, gregarious, whatever it is, like spend time with people I care about and not snapping? How do you identify what is high masking and what is potentially a deficit?
Well, I think it's important to prioritize the internal experience of that person, you know? Hmm. So if they're telling you that this experience is a 7 out of 10 for them, to not push back on that and say, well, you were able to do it anyway. Can you really do things while you're at a 7? But really listen to them. And I think that that's what helped me realize is I was able to do all the things that could check me off the list of not being autistic. But then when I took, my psychologist luckily gave us a masking assessment that assessed how much do I mask.
Yeah. What is on that?
I've tried to think of a specific example, but it's a lot of, do you go out of your way to put yourself in uncomfortable situations so as to look normal? And do you actually feel like this, but you behave like that? And that was this as part of the assessment that was just off the charts for me. Like the highest score you can get. It was the biggest mask. And I just think when you're weighing out like, oh, what if this is the normal human experience versus what if this is disordered? It's really like, how dysregulating is it for that person who's experiencing it? How difficult does that feel for them? Rather than, but you can do it. So you do it. So we don't think you have that big of a problem with it. But listening to the person say, yeah, but that throws me off for 3 days. Like I can do it. I can maybe go to that thing, but then I'm exhausted for days after.
This feels really scary to consider. And I'm saying this because I don't know enough about autism. But like thinking about high masking, of how much we forego our internal experience to present in a certain way because that's what is expected. It's what's required of your job. It's what's required of your role as a parent or somebody in the school or community or whatever, some commitment that you've gotten to. Is it scary getting that diagnosis? Was it scary for you? And should it be?
I would say first it was liberating. Like I had this weird excitement right after. Like I was totally shocked when she said I had average intelligence, but it hadn't really sunk in yet what that meant. But at first it was like permission. Like I was giddy almost, calling my husband, calling my sister, all of which.
Guess what?
The people who know me best, all of them were like, ooh, shocking. Like they had been telling me that this was autism for a while. Cause if you see me up close, you see it. I don't mask. But, so I was giddy at first cause I was like, permission. Oh my God. Like all the girls' trips that I don't know how to say why I can't go on them. You know, all the things that I don't know how to say I can do. I can go autism. I am autistic. So at first it was like very liberating and felt like permission. And then I thought, because I walk people through this, like I literally do this for a living. I walk people through the unmasking process. And the first thing I tell them after their diagnosis is there will be a grieving period no matter what. You can't escape it. There will be some grief and loss for whatever it is that you thought you could have been or all the times you didn't have the support you needed. Like it will throw you for a loop and you will regress. Because as you're unmasking, you're suddenly, it's like you almost feel, you know, back alien again. And you're, you know, just all
that's
of a sudden
really
things
scary.
You couldn't do before. Like everything's harder now. Like that's what a lot of people will report. So I always say it's going to feel like regression. You're going to go through a grieving process. Like it's going to get hard, but this is part of it. And I'll tell parents, this is going to happen for your kid. So I was like, well, I know all that. Because I teach people this every day. So I can skip it because I like already know.
Right. I'm good.
So I was like, I won't do that because like
I don't have any stigma.
I teach people that. Right. Yeah. I'm like the one to skip that. Like if anybody could skip that step, it's like definitely going to be me. And so no, it obviously
put
couldn't.
In your genius pile.
There goes bye-bye genius and bye-bye not grieving. So then we hit the wave of like grief and like, oh my God, this whole time. And then everything was harder. I felt weirder. I suddenly wanted to dress weirder and like be more unmasked. And that was that going to make people think I was weird? Were people going to think I was pretending to be autistic now because now suddenly I'm acting autistic? So that was rough. Yeah. Did you not experience that? What about for you? With
you know I did. You know I did.
Well, what did it look like for you?
I think, so I guess being diagnosed with ADHD, at 48 was a result of my daughter being diagnosed. And I think the way that it came so intensely for me is that when I left my corporate job, it became really clear that I could play the role of somebody that could be a stellar performer in sales and in corporate and just crush it, because I really like to be busy and I really like to be productive, and I put a lot of value in what that looked like. But understanding and also talking to you about like understanding how much effort it took to pretend that I wanted to be there and that was where I was. It was almost like it truly felt like a mask. And towards the end, it became so much harder where I felt like the mask was slipping off and I'm like, no, not yet, not yet. Yeah. Where it just felt like such a no feeling in my body, where being on the podcast and dancing and being with my family felt like a full body yes. Like being at work felt like a full body no. And I'm like, there's a lot of practical implications that really need to be considered. I can't just walk away. And when I did, and my daughter, I do feel like a lot of my energy that was wrapped up in just getting shit done all day, every day, was unbridled. And I think that energy turned into, I don't know if obsessive thoughts, but like obsessing over a lot of the relationships that I had, why people weren't texting me back, why didn't I have friendships that I wanted to have, was I completely wrong about some of the friendships that I had, whereas things at home were always amazing, which I'm very grateful for. When my daughter was diagnosed, I remember thinking her external expression is my internal feeling that I have fully managed, because I know I can't show up like that. And so when she was diagnosed, I asked, and I was like, yeah, we're all distracted. Of course, we're all distracted. Social media, blah, blah, blah. They took the test and they said, I'm on it. And I was like, well, I'm just a little bit ADHD. And then I started to rewind all the way back and I'm like, holy fuck. And all of the energy and effort that I put into exploring like why I was running so hard was to not behave like my mother did, who was late to everything. She was a wonderful, wonderful person, super creative, couldn't finish a project to save her life, couldn't bring anything to fruition, where I was like, I'm going to be the exact opposite. She really struggled and suffered health-wise, financially, emotionally, her whole life. And I was like, I am not going to do that. And I'm going to make sure of it. So I'm going to run as fast as possible. And I thought, good Lord, I bet she had ADHD.
Yeah.
And had so much shame that she couldn't perform in that way. So I don't know if I answered the question, but I do feel like there was, at first, I think I did feel an embarrassment of, wait, I thought I was just like different, but like cool different.
You know? Only in the cool ways.
Only in the cool ways. I could make connections that other people couldn't make. And I thought that was just my supreme intelligence. So I guess I'm in your genius file. I'm just emotionally intelligent. That's it. I'm not really book smart, but I'm emotionally intelligent. And then kind of taking a look at it as a disability of wait a minute, what has been really hard for me? What have I invested so much time and energy into becoming better at and mastering? And that was sales. My identity has always been sales. And I have performed and outperformed in it, but never felt like it was what I loved to do. What I love is like being in dialogue with people. I love helping people. And I think sales is helping. So that was a real mind fuck to like kind of unwind of all the things. I remember having a conversation with you that I'm like, all of it? And you're like, yeah, all of it. And I was like, you mean everything that I'm proud of that I have manufactured this identity. I have manufactured my identity of somebody who is outperforming, overfunctioning, can command a respectable income, and can make things happen. All of it?
Yeah.
And then what?
Yeah, that's the sad part when I talk about a period of grief that you have to go through. Because no matter what, you do have that realization with a late diagnosis. And if you're high functioning, high masking, you have spent most of your resources and most of your nervous system and most of your energy and time in constructing the mask and in hiding symptoms. And therefore, you didn't ever actually learn coping tools or language or compassion or any of these other things that somebody who, you know, was in a culture where this could be talked about. Hopefully we're changing that for our kids in an environment that's neurodivergent supportive. If you didn't grow up with all that, then you, once you do find out, you have to go back and realize all of that energy was spent on building a mask.
Yeah.
And the extra shitty part.
No wonder why we're tired.
Yeah.
No wonder why we're burned out, honestly.
And when the mask starts coming off, no wonder that we suck at doing basic human stuff, because we didn't actually learn how to do any of those things. We didn't learn how to take care of ourselves. We learned to look like we took care of ourselves. So it's crazy. And in addition to all of that, an unfortunate side effect to masking is a feeling of being fraudulent, of defrauding people. Because all we're doing is picking the survival tool that we had for other people with ADHD. Like for my ADHD, I was not high functioning ADHD. So it was clear at a real young age, this kid needs meds or something. Like I was very outwardly and unable to mask my ADHD, but able to mask the autism. So basically, like if it's not intervened upon, if you don't get the resources you need and you're doing all this work to survive and just look like you're doing what the other humans are doing, like so they don't draw their attention to you, what you end up feeling like is a fraud. You feel like you're fooling everybody into thinking you're human, into thinking you're normal. And then that in and of itself is difficult to reconcile, is that feeling of being a fake.
I think the terminology that you used before about being an alien was an interesting term to use, where we try so hard to blend in and just not ripple. Like we want to be noticed. We want to shine. But we don't want to be an alien. We don't want to be annoying. We don't want to be a pariah. And I think it's an interesting perspective of what does it look like? And I'd love to know your opinion on unmasking that. If you are asking yourself and giving voice to your internal experience, giving priority to your internal experience of what does it look like to unmask and really rediscover who you are, it's a scary prospect, because for me, everything that I built value on was a fake or could right. be a fake. I don't know the answer. I don't feel like I was faking people out.
Right.
But at the same time, if I'm not that, then who am I? And that is a really interesting perspective. And I also do want to mention that being female in our 40s and perimenopause and menopause and having these hormones layered on top of even just in your 40s, what I have noticed and being a person that coaches women who are going through transition, I think that we in our 40s have discovered that all the things you work so hard for and thought like, well, if I just accomplish these goals, then I'll be good. I'll have the American dream. I'll get the pats on the back. I've got a roof over my head. I can rest. And you wake up and you're like, wait, that was bullshit, right? Why am I not happy?
Yeah.
Hi, it's Allison. Thanks for listening. If you are going through a big change or contemplating a shift in your life, maybe it's career, marriage, divorce, a big move, kids moving out, kids moving in, blended family, or just looking to get some damn space in your calendar, and you are committed to coming out of the other side victorious, we should talk. There is something so powerful about having someone in your corner helping you clear the path for your next version of yourself, the one of your design. You can schedule a free consultation with me at allisonhair.com/schedule.
I have what I need. Why isn't it enough? So are my kids my purpose? What if I want more purpose? You know, what am I going to do? Why isn't this enough? And so I think all of those complexities layered on need to be looked at. And I don't know if there is a separation between it.
Yeah, no. And what you spoke to about women and minorities as well, like we tend to be in the more high functioning, high masking category because we're socialized that way. And we go undiagnosed more often. And then perimenopause, fun fact for ADHD people, is the reduction, like estrogen is really important in the transmission of dopamine. So, you know, as estrogen goes down, now you have even more of a dopamine deficiency.
Fuck.
So I'm feeling that as well. I'm early in my perimenopause journey and I'm starting hormones. I mean, just FYI, I don't care. I don't want to feel this way.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But yeah, it's perimenopause. If you had it all together, that'll be a time it catches up to you. But one thing you're talking about with that unmasking and the who am I and what is this all for, it brought up something that I want to talk about that happens a lot where you kind of, when you start accepting that this is what's going on, but you've been in a productivity high masking mindset for so long.
Go on.
You'll immediately,
I'm listening.
It'll kind of feel like you have these two choices, like two roads. One is it's a superpower and the other is it's a disability. And so I just want to... One frustrating thing for me is that we have to honor that it's both, because you can't just jump right into, oh, my ADHD is my superpower, and then grind on all gears on your ADHD traits. It is both a superpower and a disability, and it's nonlinear. Like, one thing about neurodivergence is we are nonlinear thinkers. I mean, that is the one thing you could say that we all have in common. And that means, you know, neurotypicals, maybe. Sometimes I think they're lying, but they give the facade, at least, that something happens in the past and then you heal for it. Step one, step two, step three of healing, and then you're good from that point forward. And it's really important that neurodivergents understand we don't work that way. We are multidimensional thinkers, and therefore everything is happening all the time and nothing is happening all at the same time, which might sound confusing, but it just means that we can be in various different emotional states at the same time. We can be in various different levels of acceptance of our superpower / disability at the same time, and just opening your mind to think more multidimensionally and make more room for all the different feelings that you might have about your process.
So I'm rolling my eyes at this because I've done this exercise with you, and embracing the disability aspect of it is really hard. And I'm wondering if you would indulge me. Can you share what the response was from the people that you shared with your diagnosis of autism? And I'm sure it varies on a spectrum, all puns intended. What was the response met with?
The people who see me every single day, it was like, duh. So there was absolutely no question, no pushback. They knew before,
yeah,
I knew. And then as you expand out of that bubble, I got a lot of, you? Are you sure? What? And then I did get a couple of, I think you're getting caught up in the labels. That doesn't seem right. That doesn't feel right to me for you. That kind of like, I don't think that's accurate. I think you've been misdiagnosed, or I think you're seeking too many diagnoses and like looking for answers, that kind of thing. So That part was not fun, because that's sort of the whole point of the masking is like, yeah, I wouldn't think that you would peg me as autistic because I've worked tirelessly my entire life to not be seen in that way.
I think what I'm trying to get at is the stigma aspect. And certainly there are people that work in this space that really understand it or have more exposure than other people. And I think from my perspective, the ADHD, it's been met with no shit, who doesn't, yeah. You know, to no, that's just dumb. It goes away. Like I've heard somebody say, well, you just, you know, 78% of people grow out of ADHD. And I was like, oh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It is like a masking kind of thing.
Yeah,
like
do they grow out of it, or do they learn to mask it?
Yes, they learn how to mask it. And so I think there is still stigma. And I would love to understand, what would you love to have updated in our brains when it comes to ASD or ADHD?
Yeah, for both of them, it is that person-centric mindset of allow the person with that diagnosis to lead the way. Like, allow that person's internal experience to be the priority. I think that's on everything that you ask me of what I feel about this. It's always, why were we never prioritizing the person who is living with this? Why are we never looking at someone? And I mean, I can't tell you how many times parents will be like, everything's fine, their grades are good, or it's getting better because you know, they stop doing these symptoms that I can see, and now they have perfect grades. And I'm right. Always like, whoa, 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 whoa.
What does that mean, though? Because I think there is a correlation between intelligence and autism, grades as a reflection of, I don't know, intelligence or ability to, I don't know, pay attention, absorb, process information. Can you help us distinguish the difference? Because I think we conflate the two when they are probably two separate, very separate things.
Oh yeah. Now, intelligence and autism are not linked in any kind of way. So you can have a person with autism with any intelligence level, cognitive intelligence, plus there's multiple types of intelligence. But so they're not correlated at all. But to think that somebody who is producing a good product, which that would be the grade, or they're doing a good job at work, or they're the best surgeon in the field, to assume then that that person's internal experience must be better than someone else's is completely false. I mean, there are lots of people who are excellent at masking and excellent at producing, but are incredibly miserable inside. And I think learning to prioritize someone's functioning level based off their internal functioning. So how does it feel to be you? Because you'll take someone who's always gotten straight A's and who got into the best school and is top of their class and always, you know, just top of their sales team. You find those people and you will rank them off of how little they inconvenience you or how much they produce for you. And instead we should be saying, but what does it feel like? How does it feel inside to be that person? That should be really like square one where you start. So I think when someone is dismissive of our diagnoses, that is them failing us, because they should be asking, does that feel right for you? You know, does that feel like the right diagnosis for you? And if we say yes, you know, then that's where they drop it.
I think we need to pause right there, because that's really powerful. Does that feel like the right diagnosis for you? Leads with curiosity and room and space for them to process. But also, there are a lot of expectations, kids in school, those kind of things, ranking metrics, those kind of things that are really, really important. So prioritizing an internal thing for a very neurotypical world, how do you navigate a world where that's not prioritized?
Starting with not saying those things are very important. So even when you said those things are very important, I'm immediately like, no, they're not.
But they are in school. They're in academics.
To those educators, right, or to those systems, they are very important to them. But that's the problem with how we get so heavily masked, is that we then assume whatever is important to someone else matters more than what I'm feeling inside, or matters more than what I'm going through.
Right.
And that's bullshit. So yeah, no, when you changing that entire structure of saying that is very important, those things aren't very important. Your child's grades are not very important. Your productivity at work is not very important. Keeping a job and making enough money to pay bills and keep the lights on and put a roof over your head, that's very important, because in this society, we don't support people who are financially distraught very well. So, you know, it that survival-wise, yeah, you have to be able to find a way to make enough of an income to pay your bills. That is very important. So not to be dismissive of like, nothing matters. However, having straight A's, getting into the best schools, always doing well all the time, always producing well, being at the top of your sales team, being at the top of your field, making the best income that you can, taking the best promotion, like all that is not very important.
It's such a different reframe that requires, I imagine, a lot of effort when the pressure to perform around you, culturally, in your friend circles, in affluent areas, in struggling areas, whatever it is, it's a lot. It's a lot. And I think there's a lot of shame that probably comes along with that, whether it is from the parent or child or internally as an adult. And I wonder, how do we start to unwind that shame?
Yeah, well, it is both by acknowledging the superpower and the disability. And like, I'm actively now going through this personally, but you mentioned love on the spectrum earlier. And one thing I like, some people think that that shows problematic. However, I, again, prioritize the experience of the person with the disability. And the people who are on love on the spectrum speak very highly about their experience. Huh. And they feel very supported. They feel very well represented. So therefore, I'm a big fan of the show, because I know that it makes the people who have autism in on the show feel supported. So that show is a good example of looking at most of the people who are featured on that show are going to be what some would either call low masking or potentially low functioning. I don't know what they've been diagnosed with, but a lot of people would agree that they're low masking. They're not easily hiding their symptoms. You can tell that there is some sort of social difference or emotional difference or regulation difference in them by watching them on the show. And so one really important thing is for people who are high masking is to look at the accommodations that the people on that show have. And it's only because they're not masking their disability. So it's really important to look at when you're thinking of unmasking or you're thinking of your needs or you're trying to wrestle with it being a disorder, when you watch the people on that show, do you feel that they don't deserve those accommodations? Like, because maybe they need a family member to help them regulate, does that mean they're not worthy of love? Like, are they lazy? Are they just like not worthy of the support that they get simply because they need support?
But help us to find accommodations, that if there is accommodations needed, if somebody is higher masking, I'm trying to use the correct terms, if they are on a lower mask, what would be examples of accommodations for somebody that is higher masking, that is not, I'm going to screw it up, you know what I'm asking.
yeah, like a high masking person, that somebody right. can't tell that they have that yes. disability. Well, I'll use myself as an example.
Okay.
Just because that feels the most fair. So shortly before getting diagnosed, I was invited on a girls' trip with girls I love. Like, favorite friends, nicest people, most supportive ever. And I said yes, like, a year prior. Like, we made these plans really early. It's all things I should want to do. But as the trip started coming up, I just started feeling overwhelmed with anxiety.
Huh.
And just thinking, just I can't get out of my head, like, what are the sleeping arrangements? There's so much that I can't control. It was sort of like a bed and breakfast. So food, I wouldn't have had a say in like what food was provided. All these things that I'm not able to put language to it at the time. I just know my anxiety is building and I don't want to go on this trip anymore. And it just keeps growing and growing and growing to the point where it feels disabling. And I end up canceling on the trip. Now, in my mind, I'm like, what's wrong with you? Why are you like this? Why can't you do simple girl things? Like, what is your problem? You're such a bad friend. You're such a bad person. You're such a baby. All these things. And then after getting diagnosed, now I understand there's a lot of unknown sensory information that I didn't have. You know, there's a lot of, you know, it was like a 7-hour car ride with other people. And so a lot of loss of control of like, well, what if, you know, I have to use the bathroom and they don't. And just all these different things that I didn't know.
Maybe I'm on the spectrum.
Maybe. Well, you're definitely in the neurodivergent world. And so having to reconcile, like, as much as I want to be a girl that can do those girl trips, if I, the accommodations I need are either to just let myself not be a girl who does girl trips. I come to your house and we have a great time and then I go home. Or I have to be able to ask for accommodations. I may have to drive separately. I may have to ask a lot of like, whose bed will I be sharing with? What's the menu going to be? And allow myself. Whereas I wouldn't even ask those questions because I
felt so... You didn't want to be a burden.
Felt stupid. I was like, they don't seem to need to know this. And that's how I've always gauged how bad I am of a person. Is like, nobody else seems worried about this. They do this like, they're all pumped. They're all texting how pumped they are. Nobody else seems to be anxious.
Can I add about the burden thing? Because I think the being a burden on other people is really pervasive. And I don't think we give enough voice to, we don't want to be annoying. We don't want to be a burden. And so a lot of that is like internalized or masked or whatever it is. Is there any validity to that? Is there any part of that that's connected?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's the whole thing. Like, that's what we were maybe told early on, or we just assumed it because we could tell that we were different. Like the alien thing. So many neurodivergent people say they feel alien. They feel like they're wearing human skin. They feel non-human. Huh. Like, they make a lot of comments like that. So I think that's a common experience. And I think that's that multidimensional thinking, is it just doesn't feel human to think like that. But no, yeah, for sure. Burden, deficit, problem. But you have to accept that you work differently. You just have to. And allow your loved ones to say the limit. Like, have your trusted allies. And if they say, it's okay. It's okay if you need this. I have this to give. Then let them freaking give it.
I think we have a challenge receiving and being a burden. I think there are so many layers of things that are coming up for me in this. What do you know that you wish other people could know now that you have a different perspective?
Just definitely to listen to that person's experience. And they've thought a long way and thought very hard and put a lot of time if they're sharing with you that they think this is going on with them. So please try not to be dismissive and just let them run that conversation. And then really one thing I feel like I don't hear elsewhere, so I think it's more important for me to spend time talking about it, is that multidimensional thinking brain. Because when you work like that and you're nonlinear, like you don't think in order and you don't feel things in order, it will help make sense of why, as a neurodivergent person, a grief or a sadness or a trauma can feel right next to you one day. And then like the next day it feels as far away as you can imagine. So to just get people want to maybe make themselves more linear. Oh, I need to make this trauma, or I need to make this issue smaller and smaller and smaller behind me every day. And to just more so work on accepting a multidimensional brain, which means you're sort of moving through an open space. And there are going to be days when you're very close to dysregulation and you're very close to old triggers and old traumas. And there's going to be days where they feel as far away as you can possibly imagine. And just getting more comfortable with understanding that that rhythm is always going to be shifting, embracing that way of operating rather than resist, because the pain is in the resistance of like, I don't want to be dysregulated today. I don't want this today.
I'm just going to clip that. The pain is in the resistance. As you think about the unmasking piece of that prism brain, right? Like the multidimensional brain. I wonder how you begin to identify what is real. And one thing you use a lot, use the term natural rhythms, your own natural rhythms. How do you decipher what those are and give them room to breathe instead of maybe layering in some shame and like shoving it under the bed.
Yeah, by trial and error. I mean, by trying to trust yourself.
How do you begin to unmask?
I think first acknowledging that it needs to happen and following. When I say natural rhythms, for other people, it's not going to feel natural at first. So
yeah.
Self-indulgent, do self-indulgent things. Be selfish, be greedy, be lazy.
Because it's going to be,
that's how it's going to feel to
like
you.
Like I'm thinking about like, I'm really tired. I'm in the middle of the day. It would feel so good to put on Netflix, but I've got all this work to do. So I'm just trying to put this into context of when you feel lazy, when you feel this.
Yeah. And so if you are putting on Netflix and then it stays on Netflix and then you lay there and you never do things that you're that are actually real goals that you actually care about, then you're probably doing it with shame. But if you're like, oh, here she comes, you know, Lady Burnout, and like she needs me to lay down for a second, and I've got to do this, then you sit down and you put it on Netflix without any shame, and you're like, she needs a moment to chill, and then your body will replenish because you're not wasting it on shame. And you will, if it truly are things that you're passionate about, you'll get up and you'll start doing those things again. But trusting that more. But that's trial and error. There's a lot of pitfalls. You're going to constantly be hitting burnout and just like pivoting between like trying to do too much and then getting overstimulated back and forth and back and forth. And it's figuring out how to balance on that razor's edge.
And it requires a lot of self-compassion, I imagine, because yeah. There are times when I'll hit exhaustion where I'm like just stressed and I'm like, I need to put this down and let it be okay for the day. But I would never do that before. So they are little baby steps, I would think.
Yeah.
Can we talk just for a moment about your Instagram account? What,
sure.
What is going on with your Instagram account?
I need to know what you mean. You know, I've had a lot of people ask me. I don't. So you enlighten me and tell me why you're asking that question. Because I actually don't know.
Let me explain for the listeners. So Cindy Robinson always had this really creative account and has always been advocating for teenagers, for youth, for kids to kind of go back to more of a playful spirit before you kind of got into more of a focus around neurodivergence. And I don't know, this must have been like a year ago. You're like, I'm done. I am done. I hate social media. I don't want to create things for strangers. I am done. And so you kind of went back in your burrowed hole. You wrote a memoir. You probably read, I don't know how many dictionaries and medical books and dissertation. I don't know what you did, but you went into your happy hole of learning because you are a learner. You are somebody that really devours data and research and medical and science and all kinds of stuff. And then you come out, you're writing 2 books, all kinds of stuff. And then you start popping up and your face is not on there at all. And you are getting little funny memes and kind of expressing the experience of what it is like to be neurodivergent and maybe truths that are coming up through video clips of like hilarious memes. And it has blown up. You are somebody that does not care at all about likes, about followers. You don't give a flying fuck. I mean, there is nobody on earth I know more than you that does not give a fuck about growing your social media, but you do want to be of service. And for you, this has become like a creative outlet and expression of taking your experience working with people in the neurodivergent space and your own experience and giving permission. It is very pro-neurodiversity, but also it is very much a permission-based thing, but it has exploded.
Okay. Well, thanks for defining it. Cause I have had people ask and I'm like, what are y'all seeing? Like I think the mystery.
You're not selling any coaching. You're not doing any shit. Of that. You're not selling courses. You're not doing any of it.
Yeah, no, it's true. I guess that's true. I guess for me, it's always been like a search for creation. It's always been about the act.
You're
of
very
creating.
Creative. You've always been very visually creative.
Well, thank you. And maybe that's it. Is I think when you are a creator, it's the act of creating that you're thinking about. And if you truly can get rid of that ego enough that you're not thinking about the response, you don't realize that there was an evolution. Do you know what I'm saying? So like you're articulating for me and now I can hear it. I can
and
go,
you're funny
oh,
as
yeah,
fuck.
Okay.
You are hilarious too.
Thanks. And that's my favorite compliment. Like to be funny, I wanted to be a stand-up comedian when I was a kid. Like to be funny is the best thing. So I appreciate that. But now I understand what you're saying. Okay, I get now. I get it. It was a pivot. It felt like a big pivot maybe or a change. But it was just for me like an evolution as this is what I like creating now. And no, I don't care. And I love not caring.
You post and ghost.
Yeah, I don't care. It's a very liberating feeling. But it is probably an unmasking thing. Like, it probably is part of the unmasking is, A, not caring. But also not wanting, I don't want my face on social media.
Is that a masking? Is that a hiding?
No, it's more comfortable for me.
Yeah.
Like, privacy and being seen and being there's this like being perceived is a stressful thing for a lot of neurodivergent people. So that's always been hard because I wanted to make reels, but you always had to be in them. It seemed like the rule
right.
was that you had to be in them.
The rule.
And then you're being perceived and like, I want to make the funny thing, but I don't want to be perceived. And so this is a great, easy way. So now I can be much more like focus on the part I like, which is the being just being funny.
Well, I think what I appreciate about it so much is that I kind of look to you in terms of the Instagram that there are so many people that are paying for followers. They would do anything to have a following. Like they're trying to crack the code of social media. And I think what I love about your evolution around it is really not caring and being able to express yourself in a way that feels really right for you. But also, it is a very unique voice. It's a very different voice. And I think there is a freedom in what does it look like to just not try and make it perfect or try and follow a trend, but just do what makes you happy. And for you, you've just been ingesting so much data and synthesizing it in a way that comes out in very funny, very creative, very relevant and resonant stuff that I think is important to the community.
Thanks. Thank you. I don't know these things, so I really appreciate you saying them.
If you see how red Cindy's face is right now. Oh, you and my husband would be like besties. You don't like compliments.
Like, we don't know what to do with them.
Right.
And it's funny. I heard somebody, I don't know if you can work this in, but I wanted to say something.
Tell
that
me.
That I think could maybe resonate.
We have 4 minutes. Shit. Before you need to get out.
Here's a very important thing for people who might be high masking and they're like hung up on, am I or aren't I? So with my psychologist, with the testing, I was like autistic. And then there was the social component and it was like not autistic.
Hmm.
And it was really confusing. The results were really weird. And what ultimately was concluded was that I am an autistic person with a hyperfixation on understanding human beings and emotion. And so because that's my hyperfixation, I can engage with people very well. And I can read how a person is feeling and process how a person is feeling and articulate that feeling to them really well. Because that's my hyperfixation. Mm. So that's something to say because I think that's what made me always dismiss it. Was I was always like, oh, but autistic people, like socially, they're awkward. People put a distance to them socially because they behave awkwardly. And I feel like people like me socially almost too much, like to where it makes me uncomfortable.
Right.
And so that's it. It's just like I mask that by having a deep understanding of emotion. Basically, I became a nerd and read a bunch of stuff and were able to read human emotion really well.
Cindy, how can people get in touch with you?
My website, CindyRobinsonLLC.com.
And CindyRobinsonLLC on Instagram because it's hilarious. Thank you as always, Cindy. We love having you.
Thank you.
You genius. Genius. Oh, Cindy Robinson is like a breath of fresh air. I've linked her info in the show notes and also want to let you know that her new memoir, which will keep you on the edge of your seat, it's called Bright Girl, Lacks Focus, is available now. And as for you, if you're looking for more one-on-one support as you might be considering a lifestyle change, meaning you are running too hard and too fast and don't know how to get out of it, let's talk. I am offering a free breakthrough call at allisonhair.com/schedule. As always, I've linked everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening and sharing this podcast and these ideas that you learn here with your friends and in your circles and in your communities. That is how you start a movement and you change a culture. Until next episode, I'll see you on the socials.